This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We're going to start with a brief look at a horrific attack at a mosque in New Zealand today. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
49 people were killed and at least 20 seriously injured in two shootings in New Zealand this morning. The Prime Minister has described them as terrorist attacks. Both shootings took place in two different mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Four people have been arrested and one person already charged with murder. It was Australian living in New Zealand who's posted a 17-minute live stream of the shootings and posted an 87-page manifesto expressing white supremacist militant ideology online. The man is currently being tried. His manifesto tries to frame his actions as part of a broader race war taking place between whites and Muslims in New Zealand. And so this is really a big curse and a problem on Christchurch, New Zealand. The city's still reeling from the 6.3 magnitude earthquake that happened a couple years ago. Now it's suffering its largest mass shooting in its history. We have an article online by Chris Eames right now framing some of these curses on New Zealand in their larger prophetic ramifications, such as, like I said, with this manifesto was about race war. So talking about some of the ethnic conflicts and other prophecies that are talked about in the Bible in verses like Isaiah 1:7 and Ezekiel 5, and just putting that into the context of rising crime across the nations of Israel, like New Zealand, Australia, and the United States, Canada, around the world.
All right. Well, do go check that out. That article by Chris Eames, Day of Tragedy, 49 dead in New Zealand mosque attacks, really a horrific incident that does draw our attention to some of those prophecies that point to the kind of civil unrest and problems that are going to be besieging those nations of Israel. So check out Chris's article there. We appreciate that, Andrew. We're going to move on to news in Britain. Britain has it's nearing the deadline for its exit from the European Union, but how or even whether it will leave has never been in more doubt. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this has been a story with dramatic developments every day. So probably the best place for me to start is just to summarize where we are right now with the latest votes from last night. So yes, Britain is scheduled to leave the European Union in exactly 2 weeks. That's the theory. That's what, in theory, the government has spent the last 2 years preparing for. Where we are now, though, is so earlier in the week, Britain voted against Theresa May's deal that she spent those 2 years negotiating with the European Union. It was the second time that they were asked about this deal. Parliament said no by a pretty huge majority. Then they were asked, would you like a no deal? And Parliament firmly rejected a no deal. And not only did they completely reject a no deal, Parliament passed a bill saying that they rejected a no deal in any circumstances. And that was that came on Wednesday evening. That was a pretty dramatic development. That particular amendment only passed with two votes. It ended up with this farcical situation where the government was asking people to vote against a law that or a bill that it introduced. But now they've really betrayed a lot of the country by saying we don't want no deal in any circumstances. Then last night they were asked, okay, well, are we going? Shall we?
So, and practically speaking, to say for the parliamentarians to say no deal under any circumstances, what does that mean with respect to the Brexit vote that the people said, and what would be the practical ramifications of that?
Good question. In theory, in some ways, nothing, and in some ways, everything. Nothing because it's a non-binding vote. They can't, you know, to the European Union could still make Britain leave without no deal. And there's nothing that Parliament passing a vote can do about that. But what it does do is it really shows Parliament's negotiating hand. It's them making this announcement saying, no matter how bad the deal you put on the table is, under no circumstances do we want no deal. It's a bit like walking up to a car dealership and saying, no matter how terrible of a deal you offer you make me on that car, I am going to buy it.
Right.
You're going to end up getting ripped off. So really, they're setting Britain up to get ripped off very badly with that vote there. And then last night's vote came on, well, shall we delay Brexit? And they voted yes to that. So what it seems like the government is going to do now is they want to hold a third vote on Theresa May's deal next week. If that third vote passes, then they'll go back to the EU and say, can we delay Brexit for a short period of time, 2 or 3 months, and get this deal implemented and leave the EU? If that third vote fails or isn't called, because there's also questions under constitutional law whether you can ask Parliament the same thing for a third time in the same session, but if that fails, then she'll go back to the EU and say, can we have a much longer extension, potentially for 2 or 3 years, while we figure out what on earth's going on? At that point, the ball's in the EU's court. People think that the EU will turn around and say, you can only have an extension if you have a clear plan of how this is going to end, rather than just finding ourselves in exactly the same situation just a little bit down the road. And so we could still find ourselves leaving the European Union with no deal on March 29th, despite Parliament's vote a few days ago.
So in your mind, what are the main issues that that this reveals about Britain? It seems like you have the population that said this is what we want, the politicians who really on balance are not interested and disagree with the British people on this point, and the way they're handling that definitely seems to reflect that reticence or that, that disagreement. So it seems like you have some fundamental issues of the role of democracy in modern Britain, some issues of the kind of leadership that Britain has or doesn't have. In your view, what are the big issues?
Yes, you're right. I can't think of any issue where there's such a massive divide between the public and the government. You've got the situation where the people voted for Brexit. However, MPs overwhelmingly were against Brexit and in favor of staying within the European Union. And that's really why, you know, Theresa May herself did not want to leave the European Union. She does not believe in Brexit. She campaigned in favor of staying in the referendum. She ends up being prime minister, though. And so, of course, she doesn't even want to leave. So she comes up with her deal, which is maybe, putting it generously, a half Brexit. Part of the way out, definitely not all the way out, and really falling short with, I think, what it's quite clear that a lot of people want. And that's why, if you look at polls, her deal is unpopular. It might be growing in popularity, because if you force people to choose between half a Brexit or no Brexit at all, mm-hmm. well, maybe there's a case for going with the half a Brexit. And so I think polls show there is some increasing support for Theresa May's deal just because of that. But fundamentally, the public want to leave the EU. They want a much bigger break with the EU. And you've got this situation where Parliament, even just this week, it was a debate, I think it was on Wednesday or Thursday, where there were MPs standing up and saying, you know, we know better than the people. They were literally saying things like, we need to get away from the myth of doing the will of the people. In their view, Brexit was the result of a minority, well, not a minority, but it was a result of an ignorant, mm-hmm. probably racist population that doesn't know what they're talking about. They know better. And they're going to lead forward. And that's why this week we've seen, really, it's been a monumental week for British government history. You're seeing unprecedented, even kind of in Britain's constitutional history, questions being raised and things being raised about just the very function of Parliament. Because you've got this situation where Parliament does not represent the people, mm-hmm. where the people want to go one way and the leaders are saying, no, we want to take you in this entirely different direction.
Right. And it seems like that divide between the people and their leaders, this exposes, it's probably been there for quite a long time. I mean, you can see that same sort of the elite governing class and the divide between that and the common man in Britain, even leading up to World War II, and the way that they were responding to Hitler's rise and so on. That divide seems like that's always kind of been there to some degree, but this is exposing it in a way that seems like creates a real crisis of confidence in the government on the, as a whole in Britain.
It does, and I think this is where it gets really interesting prophetically. I mean, there's a whole load of ways that Brexit ties in to Bible prophecy. I had an article in the March Trumpet print edition that talks about how you've got these prophecies about, you know, just unable, Britain being unable to find its way forward. It's noonday, but we grope like it's darkness. We're just not sure what to do. It talks about other foreign nations sapping our strength. But so many of those prophecies relate directly to leadership. You know, one of the scriptures that comes up a lot on this show is Isaiah 3 that talks about a cursed leadership. There's at one point, God blessed both Britain and America with some really outstanding leaders, some great leaders that did a lot for the countries. And now you've got the situation where God very specifically says, you're under curses, and one of those curses is in the leadership. I'm going to take away the strong leaders, the eloquent orators, just about the great leaders in any kind of position. And that's what more and more people are seeing with Brexit. There are so many articles this week that have been talking about how this is a failure of leadership, a failure of leadership by Theresa May, a failure of leadership by just about the entire political class, mm-hmm. that you've now got this situation where we've had 2 years to sort it out, and we're 2 weeks away, and nobody has any idea what is going to happen next. The leadership has proven itself a complete failure. I think Melanie Phillips, we were talking just before the show, she probably dealt with this best, though she's far from the only one that has been talking about this leadership crisis in Britain. Her article's called The British in the Wilderness as Brexit Crisis Explodes. But she goes right out and talks about that. She says for a people to find its courage, it has to have leadership. And for that to be provided, a leader has to be convinced of his or her vision for the people being led. And as we mentioned, there are no leaders in Britain, at least at the top of the political parties, that have a vision of Brexit. They all hated Brexit, mm-hmm. even Theresa May. So you've got this crisis of leadership. And then as she says, it may take a modern miracle to save Brexit now, and with it the last slim chance of British participation in the battle to save the West. It's really exposed a great weakness throughout Britain's political class.
You spoke about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio show yesterday. Stephen Fleury has been talking about it. If people wanted more information, they could certainly go back and listen to those programs. But anything that we could refer to them in print that would put this in its prophetic context.
Yes, like I said, I had an article in the March edition called Why Brexit is Breaking Britain. We put that in the March edition because we knew this was the month that Britain was it meant to be leaving the European Union. Of course, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen when we put that out, but we went through all of those prophecies that show exactly how and why this is going to be a mess. I also think it's interesting, you can go all the way back, we can try and put a link to this in the show notes as well, to 2016, just a few weeks after the Brexit referendum. And the article's called Brexit Exposes UK's Many Infirmities, but Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald went through some of these scriptures, and just a few weeks after the referendum says, well, everyone's talking all positive now, just you wait how this plays out, because the Bible says that Britain doesn't have a lot of strength. Do they have the strength to make a success of Brexit? They could. It could be a wonderful success, but do they have the strength to make a success of it? The scriptures say that they don't. And he wrote that, like I said, before we saw all this chaos that we're just seeing every evening as Parliament has and holds more votes.
Yeah. Very good. That's appreciate you drawing our attention back to that 2016 article. And of course, that even points back further to Herbert W. Armstrong talking about just what a mess it was going to be when Britain hitched itself to the European Union. You can definitely see that playing out as he said that it would. So we do appreciate that very much, Richard. Moving on to the Middle East, rockets from the Gaza Strip hit Tel Aviv yesterday. To learn about this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was a couple of rockets overnight on Thursday night that were fired towards Tel Aviv. One of them was blown out of the sky by the Iron Dome system, and the other one, I believe, landed in the ocean or in an open area, so it wasn't dangerous to hit anybody. But really, this came as kind of a shock. Here we are a couple of weeks out from the elections, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has done everything he can to try and tamp down any type of Hamas-led action from the Gaza Strip, because some say it would not bode well for him electorally. But it looks like there was probably about seven other rockets that were fired after that moment towards Israel. And again, the Iron Dome system was activated to try and stop these rockets coming in. Now, it is significant that they were fired towards Tel Aviv. This hasn't happened for a number of years. Tel Aviv, obviously, has got over 1 million people. It's the largest city in Israel. It's extremely built up. So if you make it through the Iron Dome umbrella, this could cause a lot of death. And so it's just another one of those signs how locked and loaded Hamas is for an attack against Israel. Now, there was only 9 rockets, because apparently even the Israelis are saying this today, that those 2 missiles were fired by accident. There was a malfunction of some sort that led to those 2 being fired towards Tel Aviv. And this comes after a lightning strike caused another missile to go off and to hit Beersheba back in November. These are massive missiles. And some people are like, well, Hamas didn't really mean to do it. Because there was a malfunction or something. But I think they're getting used to this situation or overlooking the fact that Hamas has multiple weapons ready to go, locked and loaded, that even a mishap can send them flying towards Israel. That's how much they want peace. And yet here we have a truce again worked out this morning between Israel and Hamas. So I don't know it's really difficult to find out how the Israeli civilians think about the government's response here to a terrorist entity on its doorstep.
Well, it is interesting how Israel is apparently giving Hamas a pass for this. I mean, it's very good that no one was injured in this, but as you said, those rockets are ready to be fired at any time. And in addition to this, there was also some drones that Iran has basically ready to array against Israel.
Yeah, the same general heads up basically the decision making of Hamas and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. That is Qasem Soleimani. We've talked a lot about him over this past week on Trumpet Hour on the Wednesday show as well. Well, there was a Quds Force or IRGC weapons test, I guess you could call it, an exercise involving 50 drones over at the Strait of Hormuz earlier this week. I think it was either Wednesday or Thursday. And this is the largest drone exercise they've ever conducted. These are serious drones. They're actually modeled after the one that was taken down inside Iranian territory, a U.S. drone back in 2011 that President Obama said at the time, we've talked to Iran, we'll see if they give it back to us. Ahmadinejad at the time said, the Americans have given us a gift. And so they have copied that technology. And here you have most of these drones going up to prepare an attack. To prepare to be used on an attack. This is the same style drone that was shipped off towards Israel from Syria back in February last year that packed a payload of over a ton of explosives that Israel shot out of the sky before it came into their territory. And this exercise was actually called Toward Jerusalem 1. That's what they're calling them now. Toward Jerusalem 1, this drone exercise involving 50 drones. And so it is very interesting that even as we talked on Wednesday, here we have the first military exercise of the Iranian forces after this whole Iraq debacle, where they're going to Iraq, celebrating the relationship, celebrating their partnership. And what are they talking about again? They're talking about now it's on to Jerusalem.
Iran continues to provoke. Israel is on a knife's edge. We wait to see what happens in the Israeli elections here in just a couple of weeks. But it is amazing how close it seems the fuse is always very short in that part of the world, and just about anything could light it on fire. So we will keep our eyes on that. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. Anything that you would give in the way of reading material to someone who wants more understanding of the situation?
Yes, by way of reading material, I'd read this article, I think, that you wrote a couple of years ago based on some of the things our editor-in-chief recorded. And this article is entitled "The Precious Jewel of Iran's Plan," that being Jerusalem.
All right. Well, thank you for recommending my article. I appreciate that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our weekend review program on 101.3 KPCG. A Russian official just presented a new military doctrine for that nation. It could put a lot of people on edge. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia's new military doctrine was unveiled a few days ago by the Chief of General Staff, Valery Gerasimov. And he stressed that Russia's military forces must be superior to any potential enemy. This was, it was during a speech that Gerasimov delivered at the Academy of Military Science there in Moscow. And he said, quote, "We must make every effort to ensure our technical, technological, and organizational superiority over any potential enemy," end quote. And this report also ended up using a lot of the kind of terminology that was fairly common during the very peak of those tensions during the Cold War. You know, he was calling the U.S. and its allies aggressors. That's kind of a new label for the Russian leadership, at least in the modern era. He was also saying Russia must be prepared to attack treacherously at any moment, and a lot of that kind of thing. And then one of Gerasimov's main points was about how during earlier eras of warfare, a country could, you know, maybe wait until a conflict erupted to really shift into war mode and to begin to, use its industrial capacity to manufacture weapons and armaments. And he said that used to be all right, but that in this age of a lot of computer-based, very advanced technology, that it's no longer a wise path to take. He said, quote, "The difficulty with modern weaponry is that to start producing it on short notice when the fighting begins is unlikely to succeed. And so everything that is needed must be produced in the required quantity and delivered to the troops already in peacetime," end quote. So Gerasimov is pushing for Russia to just really ratchet up its already huge defense spending and to go ahead and shift into at least the weapons manufacturing part of war mode now. Just to make sure that they're ready for conflict when it breaks out.
How different is this from military doctrine that Russia has laid out in the past? It seems like Russia has had a quite successful military doctrine for quite some time, where it just does a really tremendous job of leveraging whatever resources it has, and they're not necessarily all that substantial, but to the maximum effect in order to maximize Russia's power and the reach of its power.
Yes, they truly do harness what they have very, very powerfully, punch above their weight in some ways, although, you know, in terms of nuclear power, they, right, they do have enormous weight. But it is a fairly significant change that he's pushing for here. And this is actually the same man who formulated Russia's last military doctrine back in 2013. He urged Russia to start to use hybrid warfare. Those are those asymmetrical actions with unmarked troops and just all kinds of shadowy and kind of unclear, both military and non-military, methods of destabilizing an adversary with any possible means. It includes political and disinformation warfare tactics. That was in 2013 that he said this should be our new doctrine. And then the very next year is when Russia used those very methods so successfully in its invasion of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and the eastern regions with all those little green men, as they were called. So that whole strategy traces back to this same man, Valery Gerasimov. And it was very successful for Russia. So I think that given his track record of laying out a doctrine that was used and was used successfully, this latest one is something that the world should really take note of. And that's doubly true because this 2019 doctrine is a big upgrade from the 2013 doctrine instead of just a replacement. I think we could think of this as Gerasimov 2.0, because he's saying asymmetrical warfare is still in our arsenal.
Sure.
Those hybrid, you know, we'll still use all of those hybrid shadowy techniques as often as we can and to the best of our ability, but it's no longer enough. We also have to shift into a new speed of preparedness and just be totally armed for large-scale war in addition to that.
Well, you'd have to think that this would be quite alarming to Eastern Europe and Europe in general.
Yes. Yeah, really the main significance of this, especially in terms of Bible prophecy, is the effect that it'll have on Europe. The Europeans, and especially those in Eastern Europe that are very near to Russia, they're very concerned about Russia's rise and its increasingly aggressive and just belligerent posturing. And this fear of Russia is really acting as a catalyst for the European nations to unite so that they'll be able to band together and prevent any individual nation from being kind of steamrolled over by Russia. And this is something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has actually been forecasting for about 15 years now. Back in 2004, when Putin's, you know, his dictatorial colors were first beginning to really show, at that time, Mr. Fleury wrote an article called Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. And then again in 2014, after Russia had successfully used Gerasimov's first military doctrine to take over Ukraine's Crimea, Mr. Fleury wrote an article called The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe. And in both of those, he talked about the Bible prophecies saying that Europe will unite in the end time. And he showed, I think very compellingly, how Russian aggression would hasten that European unity. One quote from that second article of his says, quote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of the end-time European empire," end quote. And, you know, he quoted parts of the books of Daniel and Revelation and just explained that Europe's aggression will not only cause this European unity, it'll also cause a European strongman to rise up. He used the phrase Europe's Putin a few times just to show that there will be kind of an equivalent, but even more dictatorial and powerful of a man there in Europe. And there's really a lot packed into that article about just how these trends that we're now seeing are leading to the fulfillment of those major prophecies.
Well, we'll definitely put a link to that article, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe, in the show notes to the program for today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. A new internal U.S. Navy review has revealed an alarming threat to American interests. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, the Navy and its industrial partners are under cyber siege, quote-unquote, by Chinese hackers and others who have stolen national security secrets. That's according to a 57-page internal Navy document that you just mentioned, which highlights the threats of cyber warfare on the U.S. Navy in particular, talking about how the Chinese have stolen military secrets and other highly classified information. The report did not go on to obviously to highlight exactly what that information was, but the authors were taking the threat very seriously, talking about how China has an incalculable near and long-term military advantage from its hacking, and then also pointed to Russia to a lesser extent engaging in some of the same activity. And so this really highlights an interesting saying that you'll hear in military strategy, that a military strategist always plan to fight the last war. In particular, in America's case, you're spending $700 billion a year on the world's largest military, but mostly investing in technologies that were very useful during the Iraq's Wars 1 and 2. And not necessarily realizing that your next conflict may involve completely different technologies and completely different weaponry. And so it's easy to highlight the how much bigger, in just in terms of ships and tonnage, the U.S. Navy is compared to the Chinese Navy.
Right.
But then you have military strategists saying that, well, now that war is starting to go digital into the cybersphere, it's hard to predict how something, a conflict between the U.S. military and the Chinese military would eventually go if those two powers ever come into to conflict over a region like the South China Sea or some other far-flung maritime choke point. Yeah, there's actually a Bible prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 7 about a time in end time Israel, America and Britain primarily, when the trumpet of war is sound and no one goes to battle even. And our editor-in-chief pointed out all the way back in 1995 that verse is likely referring to some sort of cyber attack that cripples military communication systems, to where a foreign attack comes, the trumpet is sound, or the computer signals to the other bases is sent out, but due to some sort of cyber attack, those messages don't work anymore. And Mr. Fleury, he's written this article. I think we've published it three times, once in 95, once in 1999, and most recently in 2005 in an article entitled America's Achilles Heel and Germany. That article specifically highlighting Germans' roles in cyber warfare, but the general principle of this being like America's vulnerable weakness, the cyber vulnerability of its army and navy and armed forces, is something that will carry through to America's military interest around the world, even in spheres relating toward Russia and China.
All right, well, go check that out. America's Achilles Heel by Gerald Fleury. We'll put that in the show notes. Thank you, Andrew. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about the Trump administration's Middle East peace plan, Chinese aggression against Vietnam, German arm exports, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Trump administration is expected to unveil its Middle East peace plan after Israeli elections next month. The president has said he'd like to make this deal. This would be, you know, the deal of the century, but some people are nervous about it. To learn why, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a peace deal that's been a long time coming. Ever since he took office, he said he was going to try and work this out, and here we are a couple of years later. It still isn't released, and it is going to be released just after the election. The main reason for that is there's probably some really detrimental things in there for Israel, things that are going to be difficult for Israel to take. President Trump really likes Mr. Netanyahu, wants him to continue to be the prime minister. And so it's seen that since they are such good friends, that if he puts it out too soon, this might be backed by Mr. Netanyahu and the Israelis won't like it. And so he may lose the election. And so they are delaying it. They don't want this to interfere with the election. Well, what's interesting about this is there are other groups that are very much interested in this peace deal in the United States, namely the evangelical community. This past Thursday, not yesterday, but the Thursday previous, it was only reported this week, though, there was a listening meeting in the White House, they called it. And this is with Mr. Trump's peace envoy, Jason Greenblatt. He was there. Mr. Trump was actually had a meeting with some of the evangelical leaders after. And there was numerous famous evangelical supporters of Mr. Trump there to hear about the potential ramifications of the deal. Basically, the evangelical community are so pro-Israel, and that's one of the reasons why initially that they liked Mr. Trump, because he was considered pro-Israel. And that's why 80%, one of the reasons why 80% of evangelicals voted for Mr. Trump. And so Mr. Trump is concerned that if he puts out a peace deal that really does call on Israel to make some heavy concessions, that he may lose his evangelical base. And so he is briefing them before almost everybody else, before the Israelis are even briefed on it, on some of the potential ramifications of this deal.
Do we have any idea of what those ramifications might be? How does he reassure them, given what he's trying to do?
Right. So the big thing that's on the table is Jerusalem. The Arabs won't accept any peace deal without Jerusalem, and Israel doesn't want to give up Jerusalem. And so One of the people that was in these meetings was Joel Rosenberg. He heads an evangelical foundation. And pretty much everyone wasn't allowed to give too many details of the peace deal. But basically, there were people that came out of this meeting saying that there is going to be a division of Jerusalem on the table inside this deal. But evangelical base out there, don't fret. Don't fret, because in the end, this is part of Mr. Trump's plan. He is going to produce a deal or give terms of a deal that the Palestinians should love. Half of Jerusalem, Palestinian state, a lot of these wonderful things. But we expect the Palestinians to not accept the peace deal under any terms. And so, even though it's going to make Israel out to actually look better, because here we have a peace deal and the Palestinians wouldn't even come to the table. And perhaps at that point, the other Arab states around the world are going to see the Palestinian cause as a lost cause. And maybe they'll ditch their peace deals with Israel, or ditch Palestinian peace with Israel something that has to be worked out before other Arab states come on board with Israel. So basically, it's really interesting. They've showed these evangelical leaders, or at least told them, it's going to look bad, but don't worry, we're expecting the Palestinians to not accept it, and in the end, Israel is going to be in a stronger position.
So a bit of a gamble.
A bit of a gamble, for sure. What happens if the Palestinians actually say, great deal, let's move forward with it? It is going to put the United States administration at odds with Israel, because then it's Israel that is the nation that is not allowing this peace to take place. Now, this is really important on a number of levels, prophetic levels, I could say, is because we do expect, looking forward, some type of division within the Trump administration between Israel and the United States. There is, in the book of Zechariah, chapter 11, it talks about there is going to be a breaking of the brotherhood between Israel, Manasseh, the United States and Manasseh, and Judah, this nation of Israel. They are no longer going to get along so well. And we know it's going to happen within this Trump administration. How would that come about? We've talked about in this show that it could be that Mr. Trump pushes Israel too far in search of peace by putting Jerusalem on the table, something that the present Israeli government will not be able to accept, and how that might upset Mr. Trump going forward if Israel is stopping his deal of the century. But I think this is interesting on another prophetic level as well, and that is speaking about, and what our editor-in-chief has written about Mr. Trump being a modern-day Jeroboam, and how he has a large evangelical base that supports him wholeheartedly. And it may be that if this does go forward, and if Israel is upset by this deal, we have the evangelical base that support Mr. Trump because of his policy on Israel initially, they might have to choose themselves. Will they choose Israel, or will they choose to continue following along with Mr. Trump? And it seems like, according to prophecy, that they'll continue following the American president rather than support Israel as wholeheartedly.
So we may be seeing the beginning of a dramatic fissure between the United States and Israel. I guess we'll stay tuned as we see the way what happens when this deal is finally unveiled in April. Supposedly, that's when we should be able to see what he's offering. So we will definitely stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can find those prophecies that Brent's talking about there in our Jerusalem in Prophecy booklet, written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. Thank you very much for that, Brent. We've been following China's incursions into the Philippines. We're going to look now at an event between China and Vietnam. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a Vietnamese fishing boat has been sunk near the Paracel Islands there in the South China Sea, and this looks to have been the result of a Chinese vessel ramming the boat in these disputed waters. This Vietnamese fishing boat was about 200 miles off the coast of Vietnam near Discovery Reef. So that's in an area in the Paracels that is claimed by both Vietnam and China. China, of course, says it had nothing to do with the sinking of this Vietnamese vessel, but Vietnam's National Committee for Incident, Natural Disaster Response, and Search and Rescue says the boat was intentionally rammed by a Chinese vessel. And their report shows that the crew had to kind of cling to the bow of that upturned boat for many hours while they waited to be rescued. And if it is confirmed that this was China, which I think is likely, it would fit perfectly into a, you know, just a well-established strategy that the Chinese have undertaken in recent years of driving any non-Chinese boats out of the South China Sea, even in areas that are supposed to be international waters, and even in areas that are, according to international law, the exclusive territory of other nations such as Vietnam or the Philippines. And, you know, we know that that's because China ignores those international laws, and they claim the whole vast sea as they want to think of it as sort of a Chinese lake that they control. And based on those claims, the Chinese feel justified in bullying the fishing fleets or other ships of pretty much any smaller nations.
So these stories just happen with a certain amount of routineness, and yet there's really nothing being done about this. And it kind of seems to be greeted with mostly a collective yawn by the international community.
Yes. Yeah, I think sometimes we can start to feel like these stories are a little routine because it happens, you know, not that infrequently. And maybe we could start to think it's not that important. You know, there's another fishing boat that China illegally rammed and sunk or harassed in some other way. But that's really a part of China's strategy. Greg Poloing is a fellow with the Southeast Asia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And regarding this latest incident, he talked about that. And he said, quote, "China's neighbors have become so numb to the constant exercise of low-intensity violence and intimidation that it will warrant barely a mention in the regional press," end quote. So it really is part of China's strategy to make this kind of aggression routine, to keep it somewhat low-level, so that the world will sort of grow numb to it. In some ways, it's parallel to those Russian hybrid tactics that we talked about in the first half there. And in the process, it silently gives China more authority and more control that it desires over those areas.
Yeah. Well, looking at it in prophetic context, can you just point our listeners to why this is important, that we shouldn't allow this to just fly under the radar?
Yes. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said we definitely shouldn't let this just go unnoticed, because China's tightening grip on the South China Sea is, quote, "steering the world toward war." He wrote an article in the July 2016 issue by that title, and I'll just read a brief quote from it. It says, "Since World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. Now the American military is retreating, and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And Mr. Fleury explained that his whole view of the South China Sea dynamic there is based on Bible prophecy. He mentions Deuteronomy 28:52, where God warns the nations of Israel, which are mostly the modern U.S. and U.K., that if they reject his authority, he'll give control over the world's strategic sea gates and sea lanes, such as the South China Sea, to their enemies. And then he says that China's rapidly expanding military capacity shows just how quickly this could be fulfilled, and that these acts of intimidation are fulfilling this prophecy there in the South China Sea. So it's a very powerful article there if anyone wants to just understand these acts of Chinese intimidation in the broader context.
China is steering the world toward war. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thank you, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Our most recent Trumpet print edition talks about how German industry is doing a remarkable job in arms production and arms exports. Our cover story by Brad McDonald and Josue Michels is forging a superpower on that subject. Well, a new report by the Stockholm Peace Research Institute underscores this point. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so this report from CIPRI looks back at the last 5 years of German arms trading, compares it to previous five-year periods. What they found is that Germany is now the world's fourth largest arms exporter. United States is number one, then Russia, then France, then you've got Germany in fourth place, and then China just behind them. They also found that the global arms trade over that five-year period increased by about 8%. Meanwhile, over that period, Germany's arms trading increased by 13% compared to the five-year period that was 2009 to 2013. So that's a marked increase in German arms sales over that period. GermanForeignPolicy.com crunched some more numbers. They made an interesting point and found that if you look at the EU as a whole, judged on these figures, then they come in second place, not that far behind the United States. The United States is, according to this data, behind 36% of all global arms spending. Germany by itself is around 6%. You put all of the EU together, they're on 27%. So not that far at all behind America and ahead, well ahead of Russia, who is responsible for 21% of all global arms trading. Another thing that this article drew attention to, the German foreign policy one, is which actually Joshua and Mr. McDonald draw attention to in the article you mentioned as well, is the way that Germany also disguises a fair bit of its arms exports. So, for example, it banned exports to Saudi Arabia in November 2018 after there was the uproar about the killing of that Washington Post journalist. However, they didn't necessarily stop arms trading with Saudi Arabia. Their companies just exported via different locations. So, for example, Germany still exported the Eurofighter to Saudi Arabia. It just went via kind of English subsidiaries and so would show up on England's and the UK's arms trading, arms exporting totals. So some interesting points there from that data release. Obviously, this is just a small glimpse at a pretty big story. You know, the rise of Germany militarily, Germany's military potential. That's one of the key things that we're watching here at the Trumpet. In terms of what we're warning about world events, one of the big things that we're warning about, one of the big prophesied events in modern times is the return of Germany as a military superpower and at the head of this European power. It would be a lot of people look at Germany and look at Europe as being a bit of a pacifist continent right now. And this article in the Trumpet print, Forging a Superpower, really does, you know, it goes through and shows how Germany is building its military, how it goes through of what's happening behind the scenes. A lot of really important but not reported on very much news about the just German industry and how that could easily be transformed militarily, exactly the way the Bible says. And then it takes you through those really important prophecies, those really keynote prophecies about the rise of a German military power. So to really put that story and that Cipri story in context, like you said at the start of that article, Forging a Superpower is a great place to go.
Yeah, that article also covers some very important history. When you look at the role that German industry played in the Second World War and basically vaulting Hitler's empire into the kind of superpower status that the world really hadn't seen before and the kind of warfare that had not been seen before because of the industry. That's very fascinating. And then also just all of the detail in that story about how much the German industry is continuing to perfect these technologies and the fact that it's exporting them, that it's putting them into action in various theaters around the world and revising and improving these technologies while they're being used by other countries. It's all very fascinating when you view it in light of those prophecies. So definitely an article that you need to watch for. We appreciate that, Richard. The world's central banks are on a gold buying binge. Why is this important? For the answer, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, governments around the world bought 651 tons of gold for their coffers last year. And to put that in perspective, that's a 74% jump from the year before, so not far, almost double what they bought the year before, and more gold than has been bought any time since 1971, when U.S. President Richard Nixon abolished the gold standard. So this is a big change, with nations hoarding gold because they're losing faith in the U.S. dollar. Actually, Russia was kind of leading the charge in this effort with they bought 271 tons of that gold. So about a third of all the gold bought last year was bought by Russia. And that's part of President Putin's de-dollarization effort. He's sold 98% of his country's dollar reserves, pretty much all Russian central bank dollar reserves he's gotten rid of, and taken the money he got from offloading all those dollars to buy euros, yuan, and gold. Kazakhstan and Turkey are another big, actually pro-Russian allies who've cut their dollar reserves in half. And each of those bought about 50 tons of gold apiece. So those are the big buyers. But when you actually calculate out the numbers, which I've spent quite a bit of time doing this week, there's 60 nations around the world have reduced their dollar holdings this year.
Wow.
About 24 to 27, about two dozen nations have increased their gold reserves. So this is definitely a trend. It's a trend that happens when nations start, like I said, losing faith in the dollar's stability. Now, like I said, the Russians are buying euros and yuan, but a lot of other nations are concerned about the stability of those currencies as well.
Right.
And so until you come up with a good alternative reserve currency to hold, gold's going to have to be the placeholder, not necessarily readily exchangeable, but holds its value. And this is really pointing towards an important trend that we've reported on this program a lot. We'll put an article, A Bold Warning, America's Economic Collapse, in the show notes. This highlights what was called the late Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy, which was the economic collapse of the United States. There are verses in the Bible that talk about debt problems and the end time. There's not any really punchy verse that predicts the economic downfall of America, but there are numerous verses talking about a European military superpower invading America, verses in Isaiah 10 talking about Assyria or Germany being the rod of God's anger, and in Revelation about 10 nations in Europe coming together. And so this article, The Bold Economic Warning, our Mr. Gerald Foy points out that Mr. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy was the economic collapse of America, and that it's a personal prophecy and there's not a particular verse that points to it. But because there are so many verses about a European power invading America, you figure, like, well, how does Europe become stronger than the United States? You'd have to have, because the United States is the world's dominant economy, you'd have to have some sort of economic collapse for something like that to ever happen.
Right.
It just wouldn't make sense that Europe would be stronger than the United States unless America's economy collapses. And America has a lot of long-term problems with its economy, with its debt levels. And so this trend about more nations buying gold at any time in 50 years is kind of like the canary in the coal mine,
right,
type thing,
right.
Is that President Trump can talk about the low unemployment numbers and the high stock market values, and those are great things, but central banks around the world are less optimistic about the dollar's long-term prospects and are planning accordingly.
So, yeah, really, you can view it as a loss of confidence in the dollar and the lack of an alternative currency to take its place at present, both of which are very interesting. And say with Russia's efforts and those of a lot of other nations right now trying to find or create that alternative to the dollar, there's quite a lot of effort that's been going into that. And it seems like kind of a slow motion exodus away from the dollar towards some of these other options. You're writing an article about this for the coming print edition that people can keep their eyes on. Very interesting to see the kind of power that the United States has had because it's had that reserve currency status and how that's being eroded in recent years. So definitely keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for that coming article by Andrew Miller on that subject. And then we'll also put a link to that article in the show notes, A Bold Warning, America's Economic Collapse. Thank you, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all of the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's been a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Anne-Sophie Swetchen. In youth, we feel richer for every new illusion. In mature years, for everyone we lose. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.